Hi, my name is Gunnar Froh and I'm your host on the Wunder Mobility podcast.
All right. Welcome back to the Wunder Mobility podcast. Today I'm with Christian Adelsberger. Welcome, Christian.
Hi, Gunnar. Pleasure to be with you.
Christian, you've been in this space for many years, if I may say so, kind of like me. And we've talked about this offline before, how things already went through different cycles. And you just went through a big breakthrough with your company. You've just rebranded under a new name. Tell us about how this came about and what product you are bringing out at the moment.
Yeah, very, very happy to do that. Yes, we just rebranded to Nectre. It's only 48 hours ago since we had the brand launch with the big event and everyone very, very excited about it. And it's been a real interesting journey because why did we rebrand, right? And for us, it was a kind of an evolutionary step because did the outside world change? Did our products change? No, but we changed from the inside because when I first started the company a while ago, very similar to Yukona, I was ultimately driven by the wish to create something outstanding, you know, something people would take a look at and say, wow, no one else has done it like this before. But it was very much driven by expectations from, let's say, the outside or what I thought were the expectations were on me and the company I was able to build, right? And then later on, and this was when we started working with car sharing companies in 2019, 2020, that I discovered what really makes a difference to me and what really matters to me is actually to create impact in the business of our clients. And I had this very, I had this interesting occasion where a CFO of our first pilot customer called me and he said, "Hey, Christian, I see you on my P&L. I don't like that. I don't know what's happening there. Please, can you tell me exactly what you're doing there?" And it was super funny because I thought, oh my God, we're asking for too much money. But it was not the cost side. It was actually the revenue increase we were able to create he was talking about. So in that moment, I was like, oh my God, this is everyone's talking about product market fit. This is product market fit. And that was the moment where it was opening up for us and say, okay, let's go all in with our products for the car sharing and shared mobility industry. And while we did that in the last 3-4 years, what happened is that we got more and more interest from business fleet side, so from non-shared mobility companies. And at first, we were also like puzzled and, well, shall we support that? We chose actually to embrace that, and specifically with our charging products, to enable business fleets to create a successful transition towards electrification. And that, again, that move towards that new, that let's say different kind of market made us realize that the impact we have on CO2 reduction with our product is actually really massive. Yeah? So just as an example, the last 3 months, we've delivered 250 megawatt hours of charging energy to the fleets that we serve. That translates roughly to 1.2 million kilometers driven and about 150 tons of CO2 saved through this, right? And this is something that we only realized within the last year. And it was like, oh my God, this is like, we're doing the same thing. We're using the same products, but we realized that we have a bigger impact. And that was a wake-up call for us to say, okay, let's support that with a branding process where we go in with the all team and redefine our purpose as a company. And the outcome was this new brand, Nectre.
And for someone who's not familiar with your product, can you describe who your customers are and what it does for them, how it works?
Absolutely. So my answer will be a little bit shorter than the first one, but a little bit into history, because we started off with car sharing companies and making sure that the fleet is located where the demand will be, right? So generating revenue and optimizing revenue. We then, with the introduction of EVs into those fleets, we more and more started also to steer the charging activities. So which vehicles should be charged when and where? And that opened up also towards business fleets. So the end of the day, we take care that fleets are charged to their optimum level. And that optimum is a little bit different for a car sharing fleet, where you want to have the best match to the demand. And in the business fleets world, it's a different optimum. But at the end of the day, we take care that fleets are charged the way they should be. And by doing that, reduce the operational cost of charging massively.
So it's a B2B software product for fleet operators to help them manage the relocation and charging operations, refueling of their fleet. Plus, I left this out, leveraging machine learning technologies and so on, everything included. How are you quantifying the impact for, like, pick your favorite customer, maybe anonymous, maybe their real reference case that you're also using? What did they have before, and what kind of transition did they see after starting to use your product?
Very good question. Because and why is it a good question? Because we always try to support our case by not just convincing people that this is a great thing, but actually showing them hard numbers. And this is typically comparison. Either when you talk about rebalancing, it's kind of easy because you always have vehicles which are not rebalanced, and you can measure the performance in terms of how many trips they did in a day versus a rebalanced vehicles, and then you have suddenly a huge offset, right? And you can basically calculate the delta, and that's your uptake. In the charging world, it's a little bit more complex, but all of our customers had some sort of charging management in place, which creates a sort of charging state of the fleet, enabling utilization. And these are KPIs that we develop. And then after introduction of the service, we kind of compare those KPIs in terms of positive impact, as in availability of the fleet, for example. But of course, it also kicks into the cost side, because typically when we come in, our customers are also able to save for operational costs in terms of direct cost on the operational team side, for example, number one. Also energy cost-wise, because through wholesale contract with the large charging networks, we're able to gain very competitive pricing. And number three, and this is maybe the most future-oriented part, in some cases, in some cities, we also utilize the way where we charge. And this means we create impact for the infrastructure provider, which is actually has a monetary value, which then in some cases we're also able to share with our customers. So in the end of the day, we try to make electric mobility financially more feasible. Because right now, and I don't know whether you agree or disagree on this, but for me, this is one of the things no one talks about. But at the moment, to run an electric fleet is financially a disadvantage.
Sure.
Yeah.
Definitely, yeah, what many car sharing operators have also told us, and that they had a portion of electric vehicles and then they did the math and then they reduced those again. And I think in many cases, that's in response to a city requirement that they would have a certain share of electric vehicles or not. But it's not just maybe a software tool, because I would like to zoom into this a bit more. You mentioned now also an aspect of having wholesale prices on energy and maybe influencing where vehicles get charged. Can you tell us a bit more about this part of your product or business model? Apparently, it's not just a B2B software that would help people to optimize their existing operations, but you're also providing energy contracts to go with it, or acting as a wholesaler.
We didn't do this on a big strategic plan in terms of now we want to be an energy wholesaler. Actually, it happened a little bit through the pure fact that some of our customers just wanted to have everything out of one hand. And then the approach was that, hey, guys, I mean, you're running this service already, right? Could you also include the energy into this? Because this is going to be much easier for us. So we started to go this route. And through the fact that we, in a lot of cases, directly connect to the utility companies and infrastructure providers directly, starting to create those relationships, we also saw an opportunity to give them value by running, let's say, a number of fleets, right?
Would love to understand how the product works a little bit more, what the parameters are that you are optimizing for example. So you mentioned basically you are making it more viable to operate on electric vehicles by optimizing relocation and charging, order of charging or charging operations. But like, what parameters are you optimizing for? Is it only fleet availability and thereby hopefully utilization, or what other parameters do you keep in mind?
There are actually a number of parameters. I mean, the first one is your fleet utilization, because that's the key driver for revenue for our clients, right? And that's what they, I wouldn't say mostly interested in, but what, that's a key driver for their business. So it's relevant for us. The second side is definitely the cost side in terms of the utilization of internal operational resources, right? I mean, you always have that. And even if you work with us, you still have your team maybe in a smaller version. But you ideally want to put your own operational resource towards the, let's say, high complex cases, towards the, let's say, expensive cases, whereas the pure noise that you might have that you need to take care of is ideally handled through a partner. And that's the second side. The third one is actually, I don't know if you share that experience, but a huge cost factor for car sharing company and sometimes business fleets running electric vehicles are the fines and the blocking fees that are associated to cars being charged. And then maybe the charge is done, right, 100%. And then the clock starts to tick. And every minute the car is standing there, it costs. And then after some time, there is a fine. And after more time, they're towed away, which costs a couple of hundred euros, which can be a huge cost factor for that kind of service.
And would your solution integrate with other kind of task management tools? So you're basically feeding into an event stream because you are reading the fleet state and demand state and doing optimization work to basically create tasks that you're then feeding into, could be internal tooling, could be there are a number of external tools kind of available for the operator team to use. Or do you also provide this front end for the street runners, for the operators to handle those tasks?
It's a very good question. And why is it a good question? Because I didn't explain that before. So when you take a look at our product, the product actually has two components. And if you want to qualify the product, I would call it a technology-driven service, right? Or an AI-driven service, if you want to have it fancy. But in the end of the day, it's technology doing all the intelligence and the real-time kind of measuring things and taking decisions, right? And creating those recommendations that people can perform. In almost all cases, we also take care of the execution of those opportunities, right? Whether it be bring a car to a charger, take a car charger away, rebalance a vehicle from A to B, or whatever it might be.
When you say take care of the execution, you mean like making that task available to your customer or actually fulfilling the task? And then through a partner of yours, through like a fulfillment provider or with people that you are controlling?
So we actually take care of the fulfillment directly in the vast majority of cases. And we created a service that we call Street Crowd that at the moment has over 20,000 active users all across the markets and the regions that we operate in. So it's quite a substantial force, if you want to have it like that. We started to create Street Crowd in 2020 in Seattle, where we had exactly the case that you mentioned, like a customer using our software-only product at that point in time and said, hey, guys, there's so much we can do, and there's so much that would improve our revenue, but we can't execute on all of this. Can you help us in the execution? And we used with community crowd-oriented services in the past and then introduced that service in Seattle. And it worked so extremely well that we took this and used it as a blueprint for further service rollouts, right? So, for example, in Berlin, there are over 3,500 contributors and community members within the Street Crowd community that, yes, take a look at, in this case, the application, a Street Crowd application, where there's something to do around them and execute.
So did I get this correctly? Most of your software customers are also executing these tasks with the help of your Street Crowd. You are providing both the software and the physical service.
Absolutely.
How do you ensure the kind of service level in the execution? Do you have like a almost like a tier two support, a more integrated team that is picking up what the crowd is not interested in? Or how do you provision the service reliably?
Key question, because that's exactly what typically crowd-oriented approaches I have a hard time with, right? First of all, we solve the problem through large numbers. So when I was talking about the 3,500 people in Berlin, that means that pretty much everywhere in the city, regardless of where you are, there is someone around, right? So that means that for a street crowder, something to do is only like 5 minutes away. Yeah, and that takes away a lot of the inefficiencies that you typically have in normal operational processes. That's number one. And number two is we leverage the impact not by fulfilling, let's say, 99% and a 99% SLA on a single task. We provide the impact through the large number of tasks getting performed, right? Which means we typically do not touch the car is parked in the emergency lane. You need to get it away in the next 5 minutes. But for the vast majority of things that need to be done, they're typically not, let's call them urgent or as urgent, right? And for that side, a community-based approach is way more efficient and effective. Also, and this is the plus side, is it's extremely robust, right? You know, imagine there's an influenza wave going through a city. Typically, you know, you're a third of your operations team is like knocked out. It's just not there. How do you deal with that? For example, just before Christmas and you need to be going fast, it's really hard to deal with. With a large community, you're not going to feel this, right? Because it's very, very elastic in terms of scaling up and down with the demand that it generates.
How many cities approximately in the world do you have such communities that you can offer a crowd-based operation service?
We're currently live in 16 cities across the world, various regions. In Germany, it's Berlin, Hamburg, Munich, Düsseldorf, Cologne, Stuttgart, etc. Some other like Brussels, Vienna, Budapest, etc. But also in cities that are very, very different when it comes to the structure and also socioeconomic structure, like Santiago de Chile, where we have a customer with the name Auto, and they're live in Chile and in Brazil. São Paulo and soon also one other major Brazilian city. And it was very interesting for us to learn whether our street cred approach would also work in a city like Santiago. Because Santiago is a 7 million inhabitants beast, right? And the socioeconomic drivers are also very much different. But it was super interesting to learn that actually the street crowd approach is performance-wise even more successful there, because the demand for side gigs is very, very high. Our customer is super happy with what we're able to deliver there.
And I wonder how pricing works, if you want to share that, on such a model that kind of meshes technology and operations. Do you charge your customers like a base fee and then for each job that you deliver? But they also don't control the volume of jobs. So in the end of the day, then probably present a report of what had actually been done or like try to estimate the impact of this for them? Or how do you set something like this up? If I'm a car sharing operator, let's say a regional player with 1,000, 2,000 cars in one city, how could such an engagement get going? And what would I eventually maybe be looking at scale?
We ultimately are about creating impact within the business of our client, right? Knowing this, I always found it a little bit odd when companies would charge their, I don't know, monthly service fees, regardless of whether it's used or not, or whether it creates impact or not, and stuff like that. I mean, I understand, yeah, it might be a nice revenue, a nice part of income, but if it's not directly related to impact, I feel you don't create that skin in the game. That's ultimately necessary to make a change. So for us, we are on a transaction-based, on a pure transaction-based model, which means a specific opportunity successfully executed has a price tag. Huh? So I don't know, a car being charged, being fully charged, when that's done, successfully done, that creates service fee, and only then. And there's no baseline fees associated with it. Why? Because for us, and this is really funny, because historically we started with such an aggressive model because we wanted to start getting customers on board, right? Now we realize we want to keep it because it challenges us every single day. Because if we're not able to provide a good service and do everything we can to meet the quality metrics that are in place, we won't get the revenue. So it's a constant driver for internal improvement. Improvement. And so at the end of the day, I don't know, if you're a car sharer, you say, well, roughly 10% of my fleet size should be rebalanced every day. And then it gives you a certain volume. Let's say it's 80 rebalances a day, right? This is what we would agree on, roughly. And then the actual execution would fluctuate then a little bit around it. So this month it's 75 a day and the next month it's 85, but we pretty much deliver on the agreed value. And that agreed value comes out of the business case, because we can pretty much calculate for every fleet how much revenue opportunity there is for them, which is not yet used, right? Then we typically start with a pilot, which is a certain amount of time with limited risk, where we invest a lot to get it going. And we take care, the crowd is, the community is set up and it start performing and everything else. And then we measure together the impact, which is, as I said before, what's the revenue increase? What's the cost associated? Do we have a business case? Okay.
What would be a reasonable expectation when someone's, like for a typical client that you engaged with in the past, a regional operator, so maybe not fully optimized yet, but already at some scale, maybe hundreds of vehicles, 500 to 1,000 vehicles in the city, and they start to engage with you and basically give you a lot of, they trust in your solution a lot. You can sort of do as many relocations as you want. What kind of revenue uptake could be feasible that you've seen in the past? We're talking about plus 2% or plus 10%, 15% to much more proactive and more machine-driven, let's say, relocations.
For a medium size, medium maturity in terms of market and stuff, you would take a look at somewhere between 15% and 30%, 15% and 30% of revenue increase. That's typically achievable. So it's a significant impact.
And conversely, I mean, how are clients thinking about that? That could mean, I guess, in theory, I could provide the same service with 15% fewer vehicles if I want on the other side, like capital expenditure.
That's correct. That's correct. And that's something that can be an outcome of such an exercise, right? Because it depends on what equilibrium do you want to create. I mean, you can create a certain amount of revenue with that vehicle size. Okay, you want to reduce that, fine. But then, of course, it's going to go down a bit. But still, you maximize what is there. So at the end of the day, this is, I think, also in terms of sustainability, a very valid question. Because ultimately, do we need all those cars that are currently sitting in our cities? Maybe not, right? We know from our data that if you want the same level of mobility, you easily can cut a third of the vehicles and still have the same level of mobility, individual mobility. I think this is for me a very attractive thought in terms of reducing those number of vehicles ultimately. I mean, this is going to take some time, yes. But if I think about me and my family and my kids living in a livable city, this is what I love to think about.
Where did you see the most progress in the last 1 or 2 years in the part that you are optimizing, where your product is? Arrival of machine learning, I assume it's more recently been integrated through your team. Did that make a huge difference, or was that more kind of a breakthrough in how you are maybe organizing this crowd? Or what were the aspects where you saw great advances in the last 1 or 2 years?
That's a tricky question. Never had that before. Let me think. So you mentioned machine learning and
it's kind of, I mean, you are certainly like leveraging now, and everyone is to some extent, and it's the big buzzword, but maybe there were other things also outside or before that were big breakthroughs, like when you found a way to source people into your crowd through different channels or something like that.
Yeah. The machine learning part, no. Why? Because we actually started to use that in the early days. Yeah. In a maybe immature form and function, but at the end of the day, the core itself did not change. Yes, improve here, improve there. I believe the biggest driver for efficiency is related to the introduction of EVs, because as we discussed before, EVs as such are not necessarily a solution. They create a lot of other problems. But there is exactly where we were able to have the biggest impact on the business of our clients, because they had, out of whatever reason, they decided to introduce EVs, right? There are a lot of different drivers out there. And for example, to combine rebalancing and charging in one, let's say, transaction creates an enormous amount of efficiency. Because when you bring a car to a charger, to not bring it to the next charger, but to have a system decide, hey, actually bring it to this charger 2 kilometers away, because when the car is going to be charged, it's a high demand area at that point in time. So it's very, very likely to be taken away directly from the charger, right? That's something that has double impact, because otherwise you typically has two, let's say, transactions to cover. In this case, you can unify it in one. And it's I think those incremental improvements where I would see the biggest potential impact. But that's more future oriented. We see a very interesting opportunity in giving shared mobility providers that run on electric vehicles the opportunity to access the energy at a really low price point. If they are able to adapt to the needs of utility companies in terms of when to charge and where to charge, they can by themselves create an enormous amount of value to the energy world. And this is the ultimate thing is vehicle to grid, right? We know that concept pretty well, but there are intermediate states where if you move a vehicle from charger A to charger B, a utility company might give you a discount of 30% on the energy price or even 50%.
In terms of the timing or even the location?
Both. Because if you think about Hamburg is a fantastic city when it comes to charging infrastructure. Vienna, very similar, right? So, but you still have a lot of chargers which have very high demand. They're always full. People complain, I never find my space. But the majority of chargers are underutilized, right? If you move away the transactions to the underutilized ones, you create factual more bandwidth in high value positions. And that's worth a lot of money. Why? Because the alternative is to create more infrastructure.
And would your ambition be to have this conversation with local providers to basically you are the front end to the operator taking care of this charging optimization that includes negotiations about such aspects of pricing where and when? Because I think then ideally you have multiple customers in the same city and kind of a knowledge built up from other cities. So you are in a much better position to negotiate this and make it from an idea to an actual contract and an actual saving, right?
Absolutely. I mean, and we were talking about this. We're doing this right now. This is in production here in Vienna, where we are able to harvest that kind of arbitrage that is on the table, right? So this is happening right now, and our fleet customers saving actually a lot of cost. And if you extend that further, I believe that shared mobility as such will have a tremendous amount of competitive advantages in the future that at the moment are not yet there, because they can contribute to the overall system of energy and mobility in a city.
Yeah? So they're going to be tapping into cheaper energy, for example, but also be so much more preferred by the cities or the energy providers. And I wonder, you're building like this intelligence in different parts of the value chain. And you mentioned a few minutes back also around the relocation question to try and go where there would be demand. So apparently then you have, of course, building a prediction model for demand for your customer. And first of all, that's interesting by itself. Like, is that mostly historic demand will likely repeat itself, or what are really the important other factors? But also what else could be done with such a model if that were good? And yours presumably will be better than most local operators will develop. For example, in terms of revenue management. So do you plan to branch then into other optimizations problems that these operators have, or maybe just make that available to them so they then discover the best revenue management solution, but let it be fed by your model that you already have for demand in their case? What are other topics that kind of come out of this when you build up the intelligence that you are building up?
A super interesting question. Of course, we tackled that one a couple of times already. We decided to actually focus at the moment very much on the charging side, because that seems to be a game changer, but also can be a killer in a way, right?
So how do you mean by that? Killer in terms of being so superior to your competition and operations, or
no? I mean, I guess we've both seen some very ambitious shared mobility companies that have gone pure electric from day one and found it very, very difficult to create a positive business case, right? And to run a sustainable business from a financial point of view. I think that's what I meant by killer. And I think if we're able to create a path where at some point, electric vehicles don't have a competitive disadvantage in terms of financials, but actually competitive advantage, then we're talking, right? Because then it's the EV adoption is not driven by the sustainability thought as such or exogenous factors, but by intrinsic motivation of making more money and then having a profitable business. And that's where we ultimately want to contribute to. And that's also why we focus so much on in the area of charging, because that's in our point of view will make a huge difference. In a lot of cases, we don't pretend that we know the business of our customers better than our customers do. They know their business so well, right? And they've tried out so many things. But in areas where you have, let's say, a very repetitive decision-making, hey, this vehicle, what should we do with it right now, right? And you have a fleet of 5,000, right? So to think about every vehicle all the time, what you want to do with it, that's something that a human brain not necessarily should take care, right? So, and that systems are much better in doing this. So taking away that noise of decisions, which are thousands and thousands each and every day, to having taken care of in terms of intelligence, but also execution by a partner like us, I see what ultimately is the value that we bring to the table at the moment. But may I jump in here? Because the one question that you asked before, I actually would throw that back to you in terms of what had in the last 2 years, do you have seen any like significant changes in terms of how your customers, our customers run their business and what really makes a difference?
I think that there are topic areas that are not like revolutionary or totally new, but that we finally now begin to find the time to tackle in like fraud prevention and revenue management specifically for us. Also reliability of hardware of those sharing vehicles. And I think that compared to friends of mine work in e-commerce, for example, and it's already super optimized for fraud prevention and things like that. And we are not using many of these ideas yet. And there we saw a lot of fast progress in the last years. And then, but you also mentioned this aspect, okay, try not to pretend to know the business of your customer better than your customer. For us, that means basically API first strategy and having a product solutions team that is in conversation with the customer and mostly using low-code, no-code tools to then build on top of our product or teach our customer how to build on top. So the ideas that they have or that they learn from other industries, they can pilot them very quickly and bring them into production very quickly. But it sounds like very abstract. But there are typically right now, pricing is not differentiated at almost all operators. That's super odd for hotels or airlines to consider providing a service to thousands of users at always the same price. Or in fraud prevention, the operators or mostly customer support people who are dealing with damages, for example, have a good intuition about when they might come about, but we don't translate them into rules. And that's the first step. It's beginning more now, but then making these rules also dynamic to account for actual recent behavior, for example. It's a quite interesting time because putting something out there and benefiting off early adopters and so on to really going on the same problems with more complexity or deeper and making that easy for operators who typically don't have a ton of resources. I mean, I see the world of shared mobility really going away from Bird, Lime and like the very big ones towards a lot of regional players. And we meet more and more of them who are doing it profitably and a little bit private about it, because often they're also, of course, not publishing their numbers. It's a business owned by private people, but can be quite lucrative to run as a business, sometimes in addition to other businesses that they have. And they don't have a data science team or something like that. So they need to implement their ideas. Even the bigger operators have very limited resources. And usually that's why they are probably now successful. They don't have big HQs and big teams. So they mostly need operations people themselves to execute their ideas.
I think I completely follow your thought when it comes to, I think you called it API first or API only or oriented solutions, right? In the sense of, I think what I saw in the last 2 or 3 years was a lot of companies let go of the thought that they can control and cover everything, right? So run operations, do the data intelligence in all aspects that exist, right? It's not just one dimensional. It's not data analytics. Come on, it's there. I don't know, 50 different use cases for that, right? And so on and so on. So I see a lot of, and especially the professional one, the successful ones, let go of the need to control everything and be more open to partner with specialists like you or us in terms of getting to where they really want to be and be very clear about what their organization as such wants to really focus and what are areas that I don't necessarily need or that I don't, that is necessarily a USP of my company, right? It's like the differentiation, because running such a company is extremely complex, right? Running a share mobility or a service is super complex. And the question is, do you really want to control upstream and downstream everything? No. In other industries like that are way older, the companies have started to differentiate way earlier, right? And you really focus on one aspect of how you do want to do that. And I see that happening. I see that also happening here, which I hope opens more room for cooperation, especially between what you said, and I also see this trend, so I follow your thought there, the regional champions that are super successful, right? That are maybe not that well known and in the big media and no big funding rounds, but they run this super successful business, do that for years already. It's hard grind work each and every day, improvement, A, improvement, B, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah.
Businesses. I mean, we have to talk like a little bit vaguely because then I have to try to bring someone on the podcast who's like willing to share his numbers. But when we go into the field, we visit with operators, and these are businesses that I, for example, personally would love to own, like that are generating tens of thousands of euros of net profit per month, but that a PE I would never look at, for example. Like the conversation in some of the tech media or startup media is, of course, driven by like big deals, big funding rounds, or where investors go and so on. But these are businesses that work locally and that are fantastic for their owners, but that are not supposed to scale and then IPO or something like that. But that's totally like a very small slice of the economy that thinks this way. And most shared mobility or new mobility topics has been approached historically from that perspective scale and seeking some sort of domination, whereas in reality then most of the rest of the world works differently. And those successful operators, now is beginning the time when they are coming out more and more, sometimes really benefiting directly from kind of the flaws of the earlier system, a simple ways by buying tons of those assets at a huge discount. Also, clients of ours have done that, purchasing thousands of unused e-bikes from Bird, for example, to bring them into their fleets at a big discount. And they're picking up the pieces and have also now consumers already to some extent educated, but are running their businesses as you would a normal business, with P&L always closely in mind and very focused just on economics of the case.
I got a question for you. What would you see as the three things that those companies, and I know you can't put it all in one box, but kind of did different than others?
The ones who are now running profitably, shared mobility systems.
Who are now running profitably, yes. Who are those regional or local champions?
I think that's almost reminding me of something that, like interactions I've had with Sixt in the past. It's now not a new player, but Konstantin Sixt was an angel investor in Wunder from like almost the beginning. And sometimes when we had something, he was always super sober throughout this whole time about the business. Very sober about what are people actually willing to pay for, not what we think, so what are they actually willing to pay for? And assuming people are kind of, as they are, unloyal to most brands and looking for a good deal and so on. But then what is big enough as a business? What is actually a big business? So they are very just sober about what consumers will or will not do and what they need or don't need as a business. And then they are very fast iterators. So they are basically coming up with surprising new things, not from the beginning as a plan, but in iteration from feedback. Weird, odd examples, when we were in Riga just now, there's one of those businesses that people would like to own. Probably it's a great business, and they have a new type of vehicle, a new form factor. It's a mix of a kick scooter and a moped. It's like nimble like a kick scooter, but you can sit down. And for some reason, they tried it also, and it got good adoption in the market. And it's differentiated again, and it's hitting a sweet spot in this market. So they go with very almost uninspiring assumptions, how people are not easily swayed and don't want to spend money and so on. And then they are very also sober about a business, what it's worth, what revenue and cost should be, what costs don't have to be. And then they're iterating very fast and listening to feedback. And I see them moving around with different unexpected solutions, and then having costs of production that are much lower than we had seen before in those bigger operators. Yeah, it's kind of a part of it. What are you seeing that you find interesting in your successful clients?
It's really interesting that you mentioned it, because the iterative aspect is, I think, a very, very strong one. And I'm, can I say it like that? I don't know. Maybe someone will pick me up for that, but I feel these companies, they're not driven by, let's say, a business plan or business case as such, right? Where you have the plan, you execute it, take some time, then at the end of it, you find out you're off. Okay, what do we do? Close down or what? Yeah. But they're way more driven by direct customer feedback, but in its purest form. And it's not feedback, hey, I would like to have, but what people then actually by the behavior but the actual behavior of those customers. Because what people say what they want and what they want is not a, it's not the same thing every time, right? And companies who are able to react quickly and also test those, you have an assumption, okay, you better try it out. It might confirm or not confirm, right? But we're able to do this in quick matters and are not shy to also admit failure or wrong assumptions or I don't know, but also are open enough to grab an opportunity when it shows up, right? Oh, there's something happening. Oh, people do like this. Why do they do this, right? Not, oh, they're stupid, but why? Why are they doing this? That there must be a reason for it, right? Can we leverage that? Can we support that reason potentially? I think those companies ultimately have never stopped to question themselves. They never stopped they never called it a day in terms of, yeah, now it's good enough. It's a constant drivenness towards getting better.
Yeah, and in that sense, I think that we went through like the valley of death or where like a difficult time in shared mobility was for the last years because of like overblown expectations, like a lot of cleanup had to happen. But now we're entering more and more into a time of expansion again and profitable business models. And I think it's going to be not back to the beginning though, like the crisis over back to where we started out was actually going to be different, but it's going to feel much better because in the beginning, I think it was also clear that there would be disappointments because it was basically a fight for trying to oligopolize or monopolize certain areas, and all was back kind of to the Peter Thiel virus and competition is for losers, and you have to like build your monopoly, but that's like a very big exception when it's actually happening. And in reality, it's this constant struggle, but that once you're getting good at it, doesn't feel like a struggle anymore. It's just normal that there is constant iteration and focus on efficiency and competition. Mm.
I would totally agree what you said there in terms of, it reminds me of the the old days. So when I started my own like the business life, it was the early 2000s, right? And I remember 99, 2000, 2001, where like there was an enormous bubble and enormous expectations, which in a lot of cases didn't confirm, but it was the Wild West at that point in time. Very similar to like, I don't know, 10 years ago in the shared mobility industry. At the end of the day, that valley of tears hit that industry really, really hard. But the really successful businesses were at the end of the day coming out of that phase. And I really like the how you portrayed it, the word you used, the soberness. Yes, it's maybe not as shiny, it's maybe not as as loud, right? But it's constantly building and creating something. So I really feel that we're talking about generation 2.0 of shared mobility that's forming right now, and that's not necessarily diluted by capital-driven expectations. Which I think is ultimately a good thing.
Yes, and I think having gone through this other phase as well, it gives us this background to be very alert for when this comes up again, when we are tempted to go in this direction or when we see something that sounds like a great idea, but we quickly go to, okay, do consumers actually follow it? Is there actually money spent on this? And yeah, more talk and actual impact, like you mentioned you are doing with even like in the pricing world going in this way directly. And basically, I think you are calling this right, that there is the next phase coming. And I see in our industry a lot of brands changing, and you just did a rebranding, but I mean like really companies actually exiting and other companies coming, but often the same people still the same name, different company. And I think there's a lot of knowledge now building up with this industry, with this group of people, and it would be great, and people will really benefit. If those are the first and earliest investors, in some cases, Maybe not. You were like an investor in Bird at the time, but hopefully there's something left to invest now. And then the chances of that succeeding are much higher.
Absolutely. I think one thing that I just want to bring into what you just said on top of it is towards the expectation side is time. Because I feel building a service and a company in a field that's in the early stages itself as an industry or as a market, it just takes some time to create something robust. Like in Mother Nature, where you have a tree, right? It takes a couple of years actually to have that stem be so strong that if the big wind comes, if the storm comes, it's strong enough to keep that, right? So no big branches first because whoop, the wind comes and it's gone. So taking that analogy back into business, we've literally analyzed the data of dozens and dozens of shared mobility providers, yeah? Specifically in the car sharing world. And what we've seen is that there's, or at least we interpreted it from the data, it takes a minimum of 4 years, if not five, to get to a point where you start to really be able to improves and fine-tune that business. That the time before, that's just growth as it has to be. You can't shortcut that, in my point of view. Yeah. To the idea of creating one blueprint and then rolling it out to 150 cities in the next 6 months, I'm quite skeptical about. It was really interesting to see that from that data because even my own perception of time was different. I thought, no, this is faster, right? This is like I saw it. But it's shaped by media and by a lot of, let's say, messages that we give each other all the time. The truth is it just takes an awful lot of time to create a certain robustness and a critical mass of business and intelligence that's inherent in an organization to be strong enough to really sustain.
I agree. That's the normal way. And that's kind of the anti-thesis to almost like Reid Hoffman's split scaling book and hypothesis and this whole philosophy around 10 years ago, kind of peaked like with the first unicorns and so on. And Airbnb was a part of that. And Reid Hoffman was on the board there. And he's also writing in the book about how Airbnb is basically going international so quickly and all that, like celebrating this. But there were two aspects, I think, to keep in mind with this whole philosophy. And one is simply that it's more an exception and exceptions don't describe the rules. Every now and then something can happen, but it doesn't describe how things usually happen. But the other thing is also, shouldn't forget how massively those examples are usually kind of overfunded and backed by so much capital. So there is just that's over covering every inefficiency and every shortcoming because some people are trying to oligopolize, monopolize a certain market. So it's a very unusual and for most participants unhealthy in the end of the day. Because of course,
absolutely.
Yeah, of course, those investors would do that and fail in most cases and in some cases succeed. And if you're holding a portfolio as an investor, that's okay. But if you are spending the 10 years working in one of those companies and then it fails, then that's not great. So most of what we will see on the market doesn't work like that. And I really takes years to build this experience individually and as organizations.
Wow, where this discussion brought us already.
Yeah,
it's pretty amazing.
Yeah,
I really enjoy
two veterans. All right. I mean, thank you for taking so much time today already in the middle of 48 hours after rebranding and in the middle of expanding. I think it's quite important that people understand. I didn't fully understand this before, that you had not just the software, the intelligence part, but also the operational part on the ground, how you are approaching this, like with this true entrepreneurial, like risk sharing perspective, as you go in for car sharing operators to show the impact that you had and they pay for transactions. And I think, with this mission behind that you kind of sharpened now and make so central in your messaging to say we want to accelerate the transition to EVs. And in the end of the day, that has to go by economic superiority. So we are going to leverage our crowd operators, but also our intelligence to make EVs the superior vehicle. And it's fascinating what kind of different aspects you can tap into to do that, even optimizing energy pricing as part of your equation and negotiating on their behalf. So it was super cool. Thank you for spending this time with us.
Gunnar, thank you. It was a huge pleasure, and I hope we can repeat that in maybe in a different setting because it's been really fun.
Sounds good.
Yeah?
Let's do that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.